Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English expression teaching series, Words and Their Stories, with Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember brings us the latest in the ongoing American history series, Making of a Nation. But first, the Higher Education Report with help from Alice Bryant. As growing numbers of young people report struggling with mental health issues, colleges and universities across the United States are working to meet their students' needs. But a new study suggests that one group of students is facing these issues more than any other, transgender students. And some experts worry that many schools may not be doing enough to meet their needs. Transgender people are people who no longer identify with their sex from birth. They feel they are really members of the opposite sex. Many often change their name, appearance, and even undergo medical treatments to help match or keep up with the way they feel. In 2016, about 1.4 million Americans identified themselves as transgender. That number comes from the Williams Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles's School of Law.
Earlier research has shown a growing number of U.S. college students have reported depression, anxiety, or other mental health issues in recent years. This latest study attempts to examine the specific problems transgender students face. The findings were published last month in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. Researchers looked at information from an internet-based survey called the Healthy Minds Study. It involved 65,000 adults who studied at 71 U.S. colleges and universities between 2015 and 2017. All of them were questioned about their mental health. Out of that group, about 1,200 students reported having an alternate gender identity, meaning they do not identify with their birth sex. The researchers found that almost 80% of those students reported dealing with at least one mental health issue. For comparison purposes, 45% of cisgender students, those who identified as their birth sex, reported having a mental health issue. Sarah Ketchen Lipson is an assistant professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. She was one of the lead researchers for the Healthy Minds study. She also helped to prepare the report on transgender students. Lipson argues one troubling thing about the findings is not just that transgender students were more likely to face mental health issues than other students. Transgender students also were more likely to face every single kind of mental issue raised in the study, especially thoughts of suicide and attempting suicide.
There are many reasons for this, she says. Some causes of mental health problems can affect transgender students long before they ever go to college. For example, there are higher rates of family abandonment and homelessness, notes Lipson. Once they do enter college, transgender students still face difficulties that may not be as clear to cisgender people, she says. Many U.S. colleges and universities are at least somewhat supportive of gay and lesbian students. But there are still barriers to transgender students feeling fully accepted. This includes the fact that many schools force students to use their birth name or gender pronoun and make changing this information on school records difficult. Restrooms are meant only to be used by people of a specific sex. And while schools may have policies to prevent discrimination against gay or lesbian students, their policies often fail to identify transgender individuals. Lipson suggests that all of these seemingly minor issues can intensify existing mental health problems, if not create new ones. The report's findings do not surprise Shane Windmeyer. He is the executive director of Campus Pride, one of the largest organizations supporting lesbian, gay, and transgender college students in the United States. Windmeyer notes, while most colleges and universities employ trained specialists to support different minority groups, that is not the case for trans students.
Trans folks are not even visible on many college campuses, he says. They are not seen as a population to serve, still, on many campuses. Windmeyer adds that dealing with all of these mental health issues makes higher education seem much harder for these young people. Mental health problems make success in their studies that much harder, he says. What is worse, most schools do not even give students the choice to report their chosen sexual identity on official documents. So administrators have no way of knowing how well or how poorly they are serving transgender students, he says. Windmeyer argues that to know how to better help such students, school officials must be open to understanding their needs. This comes through a willingness to make changes when needed. But he and Lipson agree that it also comes from being better informed. Schools must employ physical and mental health experts who understand the issues transgender students face. But they also must teach cisgender students, professors, and employees to be accepting of and communicate with trans students in ways that make them feel welcome. Allyship requires education, said Lipson. It requires knowledge. It's not enough to be well-intentioned. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore common expressions in American English. Today, we take our show on the water, on a boat, or at least a make-believe one. You have probably seen a boat before. Watching one move through the water can be really fun. On the water, boats move with a grace similar to that of a plane in the air. If you are lucky, you may have even sailed in a boat. That experience to feel the wind and water droplets hitting your face, to be out in the open air, is so much better than simply watching it from a distance. However, not everyone enjoys being in a boat. In fact, many people get sick from the rocking motion of a boat. When boats are on calm water, the water moves it back and forth, back and forth. This can cause many people to get seasick. And that brings us to today's expression, rock the boat. This means to cause problems for other members of a group. When you rock the boat, you do or say something that causes change. Now, we usually rock the boat in a negative way. Used this way, it means to cause trouble, usually by changing something. But you can also rock the boat in a positive way. Here's how. Another meaning of rock the boat is to question the status quo or the usual way of doing things. So, if a situation is no longer healthy or good, then making changes is a good thing. For example, one job of the media is to sometimes rock the government's boat. You know, shake things up a little. The expression rock the boat has been used since the early 1900s. And it should come as no surprise that it comes from boating. Imagine that you and a friend are at sea in a small boat. Suddenly, you get up and start moving your weight from side to side. Naturally, the boat starts rocking. Your rocking of the boat does not just affect you. It also affects your friend. She starts to feel seasick. But you don't seem to care. You just keep on rocking the boat, and you rock it so hard that it overturns. You and your friend end up in the water. So you were both fine in the boat before you started rocking it. Now, with both of you in the water, the situation is worse. It is worth noting that another expression means about the same thing and has a similar history: to make waves. The rocking of a boat is caused by waves in the water. In life, when you make waves, you change the usual way of doing things. Again, this can be good or bad. So that is where these expressions come from. Now let's hear how to use them. Two co-workers, Marissa and Thomas, are heading into a meeting at the chocolate company.
That's a big binder. What's in it?
This binder has all my suggestions.
Suggestions on what?
Suggestions on how to improve our overall chocolate products, customer service, production, delivery systems, all without increasing our costs.
Wow, those are a lot of suggestions. You know, now may not be the best time. The economy is tanking, and everyone here is really happy.
What are you saying?
Well, maybe now is not a good time to rock the boat. Things aren't great, but they are pretty good.
That's what I mean. Why be okay when you can be great? Now is a perfect time to rock the boat. Let's challenge the status quo.
Look, Thomas, you've only been here a week. Why don't you observe and learn a little more before you make waves?
You know, that's a good idea. I can always present my suggestions next week.
Yes, I'm sure you will.
And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We begin the story of a document that defined a nation, the United States Constitution. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain in 1776. But they had to fight for that independence in a long war that followed. During that war, the states were united by an agreement called the Articles of Confederation. But the Union of 13 states was loosely organized. The Articles of Confederation created a weak central government. The document did not create courts or provide for a president or other executive to carry out laws. The Articles of Confederation did create a Congress, but that legislature had little power or money. When British General Charles Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia, a messenger brought the news to the Congress. But Congress could not even pay the messenger, so money had to be collected from each member. The war ended in 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. Even before then, three influential Americans had called for a change in this loose confederation of states. The three were George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. They urged the formation of a strong central government. George Washington commanded America's troops during the Revolution. He opposed the Articles of Confederation because they provided little support for his army. His soldiers struggled with shortages of food, warm clothing, shoes, and other supplies. Here is an actor playing George Washington in a show at the National Archives. He is talking about the Articles of Confederation.
In my mind, it prolonged the war by several years. Every time I needed men or money to prosecute the war, I had to go to 13 sovereign heads of state hat in hand. Even now, under peacetime conditions, we are like a giant with 13 heads tottering towards a cliff.
Alexander Hamilton was a young lawyer who served as an aide to General Washington during the Revolution. Hamilton called for a convention of the 13 states to create a new central government. He expressed his opinion in letters, speeches, and newspaper articles. Finally, there was James Madison. He was one of the authors of the state constitution in Virginia in 1776. When Madison, Hamilton, and Washington looked at the Articles of Confederation, they saw an unhappy picture. There were 13 governments that each tried to help themselves at the expense of the others. Each state had its own army. Nine states had their own navy. The states had these forces to protect themselves from each other. For example, Virginia passed a law which said it could seize ships that did not pay taxes to the state. Virginia did not mean ships from Great Britain or Spain. It meant ships from other states, like Maryland and Pennsylvania.
Basically, the thought was, we need a military defense structure, we need a modest army and a navy, we need to regulate trade with Europe, and individual states in a loose confederation won't do the job.
Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School. He says Americans realized a strong central government could improve their national security system. In 1786, representatives from Maryland and Virginia met to discuss opening land for new settlements along the Potomac River. The Potomac formed the border between those two states. The representatives agreed that the issue of settling new land was too big for just two states to decide. Someone asked, why not invite Delaware and Pennsylvania to help? Someone else said, all the states should be invited. Then they could discuss all the problems that were giving the new nation so much trouble. The idea was accepted, and a convention was set for Annapolis, Maryland. The convention opened as planned, but it was not much of a meeting. Representatives came from only five states. The men who did meet at Annapolis, however, agreed that it was a beginning. They agreed, too, that a larger convention should be called. They appointed the representative from New York, Alexander Hamilton, to put the agreement in writing. So Hamilton sent a message to the legislature of each state. He called for a convention in Philadelphia in May of the next year, 1787. The purpose of the convention, he said, would be to write a constitution for the United States. The nation was new, but the idea of a constitution was not. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar explains that the earliest settlers had formed political agreements called compacts, charters, or corporations. These agreements developed into state constitutions.
And then, in 1787-88, the idea becomes to try to continentalize, to take on a much bigger scale, this idea of a written constitution setting forth the rules for how people would govern themselves, what government could do and not do, what their powers would be, and what the limits would be.
Even so, he says, Americans were not sure about creating such a constitution. Amar says they were afraid a new central government might be as arrogant and out of touch as the King of England had been. However, most people slowly came to believe that a strong central government would protect their country better than the loose union of 13 states could. Many people also believed that a constitutional convention would not succeed without George Washington. People wanted to elect him president of the convention, but Washington did not want to go. He suffered from rheumatism. His mother and sister were sick. He needed to take care of business at Mount Vernon, his farm in Virginia. And he already said he was not interested in public office. George Washington was the most famous man in America. Suppose only a few states sent representatives to the convention. Suppose it failed. Would he look foolish? Two close friends, James Madison and Edmund Randolph, urged George Washington to go to Philadelphia. He trusted them, so he said he would go as one of the representatives of Virginia. From that moment, it was clear the convention would be an important event. If George Washington would be there, it had to be important. The first delegate to arrive in Philadelphia for the convention was James Madison. Madison was 35 years old. He was short and losing his hair. He was not a good speaker, but he always knew what he wanted to say. He had read everything that had been published in English about governments, from the governments of ancient Greece to those of his own time. Madison believed the United States needed a strong central government that was more powerful than the 13 states. Madison also knew that he should not push his ideas too quickly, so he planned his work quietly. He came to the convention with hundreds of books and papers. He was prepared to answer any question about government that any other representative might ask him. Madison asked the other delegates from Virginia to also arrive early. He wanted to enter the convention with a plan for a strong central government. He was sure no other state would do this. Two Virginia delegates came early as requested. Together, the three men worked on Madison's plan. The only other delegates there were from Pennsylvania. Nobody seemed worried that there were no delegates from the other 11 states. After all, it took 2 weeks to ride a horse to Philadelphia from New Hampshire in the Northeast, and it took as long as 3 weeks to get to Philadelphia from Georgia in the South. Finally, the other delegates started coming, a few at a time. 55 men in all from 12 states. Pennsylvania sent the most delegates, 8. Rhode Island sent none. A few of the delegates were very old, but many were in their 20s or 30s. The average age of the delegates was just 43 years. From the moment the convention began, Madison kept careful records of everything everyone said. He never stopped writing. If it were not for James Madison, we would know little of what happened at that historic meeting in Philadelphia in 1787. Later, Madison explained how he did it. He wrote, "I sat in front of the president of the convention. All the other delegates were on my right and on my left. I could hear everything the president said. I could hear all the words of every delegate. I made notes only I could understand. Then, at night in my room, I wrote out completely all the speeches and acts. I attended the convention every day. I was there as long as the delegates were meeting and talking." James Madison's full records of the convention were not published until 30 years later.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.